Psychological Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
You know, I realized the old York Times, I couldn't sleep last night. I went to sleep 8:30 at night and got up 2 in the morning and laid in bed until about 3 when I heard the newspaper thwop on the driveway. And I said, my God, what a high carbon thing this is, newspaper delivery. This is really high carbon. That paper comes to me. Think about it. There's some poor immigrant. Gets up probably at midnight, picks up this stack of dead trees and printer's ink, drives around spewing carbon from his old, you know, leftover, you know, like a Toyota, whatever, poor guy, poor woman, and drives around with this heavy piece of newspaper, throws it on my driveway. I said, what would Pinchy Sulzberger do if someone pointed out that just delivering newspapers is a high carbon experience? In fact, most of the stories about the myth of global warming are put out by these newspapers, these comic books for stupid adults. And they're delivered in the most high-carbon fashion imaginable. See, most of the people who read the internet have read competing theories on what's causing this slight uptick in global temperature. And I say slight uptick, like maybe a half a degree a century. I'm a boater, for God's sakes. The tide charts were written a long time ago. They're accurate down to the inch. There's been no rise in sea level anywhere. I keep calendar year after calendars year after year. It's about the same temperature year after year, the same thing, over and over again. But if you look at the data, there's been like a half a degree in 100 years. Now, whether man is doing it, whether it's anthropogenic, is the argument. But those who are disseminating the idea that the world is about to come to an end because of global warming are mainly those who write for newspapers. And those who read it are generally people with lower intelligences who simply read newspapers. But what they don't realize is that the vehicle that is delivering the news to them about so-called global warming is really a very high carbon delivery system. I thought about that 3 in the morning. I had to entertain myself somehow to keep from climbing the walls altogether. Now, maybe that's the sign of intelligence. Do you know that I dream in not only 3D but Technicolor? If I could tell you the number of dreams I have every night, and I remember all of them in detail, I actually painted paintings last night. In my sleep, I painted masterpieces where I saw the brush, I saw the paint, I saw the bubbles of the paint. I couldn't believe this. I actually look forward to going to sleep every night because my dreams are far more interesting than my life. I have the most phenomenally interesting dreams, more interesting than any movies I've ever seen. And the older I get, the more interesting my dreams become. I'm starting to wonder if, you know, that's not the other world. The next world is over there. Wow. Interesting world. So anyway, to make a long story short, the high-carbon newspaper comes on the driveway. And I got it this morning, and I put 2 yellow tags on the old York Times. One is, Turk lawmakers. They're so PC, the Times. Not Turkey, not Turkish, but Turk lawmakers. They always look up the right way to say things to not be offensive. That they're experts on. Their IQ is very high on non-offense. Turk lawmakers grant authority for raids in Iraq. Why Turk? Well, because some of the lawmakers may not be Turkish. They could be Kurdish. You see? See how smart they are, the boys from NYU? You see how smart, how they use their intelligence? But they don't tell you it was Nancy Pelosi who forced the Turkish parliament, or shall I say the Turk parliament, both old and young Turks, to vote to invade northern Iraq to confront Kurdish rebels. It was Nancy Pelosi and her Democrats who actually provoked this. That they don't tell you. Next article that I noted was, this is a shocker. A shocker. U.S. concerned as Iraq awards power deals to Iran and China. I almost fell over when I read this. Those backstabbing SOBs in Iraq, they're the most miserable people on earth are the Iraqis. They are the most backstabbing group of SOBs on the entire planet. These rats, we've spent, what, trillions of dollars liberating them from Saddam? And now when they have a little oil flowing and they have money, they're going to award the construction of power plants to Iran and China? Those backstabbing vermin. I wouldn't let them do it. But why should we permit them to do it? What, are you kidding me? What kind of government do we have? They take our money to liberate those ingrates in filthy nightshirts who continue to kill each other's women and children outside mosques. And then to add insult to injury, when they're about to build power plants, they award it to Iran and China, the construction contracts. This never would have happened in World War II. After Germany was devastated and during Reconstruction, I doubt very much that contracts would have been awarded to anyone other than General Electric, General Motors, etc. Since our nation had been depleted in fighting World War II, you would figure that perhaps we want to refill the coffers in some manner. But this, again, is an example of the lack of leadership in the administration. I have to tell you that. Who else do you blame for this? How could you blame anyone but George Bush for this? How could you blame anybody but Bush for this? U.S. concerned as Iraq awards power deals to Iran and China. How could they do this? How could you permit Iranians to come and build power plants in Iraq? How could you do this unless you're an absolute idiot and totally out of control? So then that's at 3 in the morning. You see what bothers me? No wonder I sleep so much. You wake up to this kind of news, it's no wonder that I dream in Technicolor. Putin attacks U.S. foreign policy, announces new nuclear weapon. This is getting ugly. This is getting ugly. He says that they're building a new nuclear submarine, Russia. You hear this? And he said we have grandiose plans and they are absolutely realistic. And he said we are going to develop a new generation nuclear weapon that will stun the world. We haven't heard anything from the Federation of Concerned Atomic Scientists. They're suddenly silent when their good friend in Russia is talking about building a new generation of nuclear weapons. They only have big yaps on them when it comes to the American military having a nuclear weapon. But if Russia, oh, they're entitled to it. Federation of Concerned Scientists, all fellow traveler communist wobblies, all of them. All raised in Brooklyn, Bronx, Manhattan, over oilcloth by ILGWU parents who taught them to hate the country and to spit on the ground every time they left the apartment, in my opinion. How come they have nothing to say about Putin saying he's going to develop a new generation of nuclear weapon? How can he say, when he said that Russia will build another nuclear submarine, we didn't hear any of these anti-nuke lefties go crazy in America. He says that they're also planning a completely new atomic weapon. How come they didn't get excited over that and say that it's 1 minute to midnight? Those morons. Commies, that's what they are, 100%. But do we need a nationalistic government? Wow, I don't see how we're going to survive. Anyways, I made one new point that you never heard before. Newspapers are high-carbon deliveries, which is very funny, actually, when you think about it. You could now throw this in the face of your newspaper-reading friends. That savage said that the paper you're reading is a high-carbon vehicle. Tell that to Phil Bronstein. All of these guys who are in the newspaper business, when you think about it, they're all, oh, they're so liberal. They're all, oh, yeah, global warming. They walk around like high priests of global warming with a sanctimoniousness that you need a clothespin on your nose to prevent the stench from entering your being. Oh, yeah, they're the high priests of global warming and everything else politically correct. And how do they deliver these ideas? Through the most high-carbon form of communication that there is. Newspapers in a driveway or at a newsstand delivered by a gas-stenching, a fume-stenching truck. See, it takes Savage to figure these things out. I mean, you say, well, maybe that's a mark of intelligence. I would agree with you. I'll be right back.
Yeah. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Frank, welcome to the program from WRKO in Boston. How are you? How are you? How are you? What's on your mind, Frank?
How are you, Mike? It's good to talk to you again.
My friend Frankie from Boston. What's happening?
Well, I wanted to call you. I'm going to Italy on Sunday. And
God bless. You're a lucky man. You're a lucky man. A lot of Italians go in this time of the year, huh?
It's the perfect time of the year. The weather is about the early 60s to mid-70s, depending on where you go. And there's not much rain. So, you know.
It's a beautiful, there's perfect autumn weather before after the sun, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So I can't wait, man. I'm really looking forward to it. So I thought,
where are you going? Where are you going in Italy?
Well, we're going to Rome. We're heading to Venice, Florence. We're going to the Amalfi Coast, island of Capri. We're going to go to Modena. So we're gonna hit the.
What are you going in to buy a Ferrari?
No, Ferraris on this trip, Mike. Maybe the next one.
So, do you have family over there, Frank?
Well, there's a town over there. I'm not sure. I might have family there. We're going to go to a town that's after my last name, so I don't know if we took the town's name or.
It wouldn't be Corleone, would it?
No, not Corleone. No.
So, what are you going to eat over there, Frank?
I'm going to eat everything that I see, Mike, and I'm going
to. Stop it now! But what are you really looking forward to that you can't get in Boston?
Just the whole cuisine over there is different than in America, Mike. You know, and
well, I got a friend who owns a Sicilian restaurant in North Beach. I like eating there a lot. So he tells me that when he goes to Sicily, where he has a house, he said, Michael, he said the people eat for 3 hours at night. They eat slowly, not like you. He said they take course after course and they converse. He knows I call him in advance and say, make this. I come in, I eat, boom, have a drink and leave. He said, we don't eat that way. I said, I can't help you. But he said, we sit and we talk and we chat. They don't watch television. It's a different world, isn't it?
It's a different world. It's much slower. They enjoy life better, and that's why they live longer. So I'm going to dip my bread.
I wish I would be there with you, Frank. My traveling days are frankly over. I did a lot of great traveling when I was young. The kids were younger. I don't travel as much anymore. To me, being on that airplane is a torment beyond. You know that poor woman who got handcuffed and died in the prison in Phoenix Airport a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah.
I fear that every time I get near an airport, that if I say one wrong word, they're going to shackle me and put me in a back room.
Well, I don't like airplanes either, Mike, but, I got to do this before I die. So.
It's like rigidity on the plane. I flew back from Miami the other day. I swear to God, God bless them, they were the nicest flight crew in the world. There was no water in the toilet. For 6 hours, the crew, you go in the bathroom, there's no water in the sink. I couldn't believe this. I said, wait a minute. If the crew that put water in the sink forgot to put water in the sink, maybe they forgot to put hydraulic fluid in the steering gear? I mean, what's going on here?
Well, I'm going to try to not keep those thoughts, Mike, and just...
No. I didn't mean to bum you out. Enjoy every minute of it. Take 3 10-milligram Valium and a bottle of red wine, and you'll be there before you know it.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike. I appreciate it.
Hey, God bless you. Tell me when you find Scungili over there. You better eat that Scungili before the global warming kills him, or before the Global Warming Committee eats him. One or the other, I don't know. It was quite a flight. It wasn't bad. I even had a meal. It was a sandwich in first class. Have you ever seen cuisine like this? I never saw anything like this. Like fifth grade school lunches in the Bronx in the 1950s were better than what's served as first class food. I mean, you've heard every joke in the world. It's unbelievable to me. I never saw anything like this. You pay through the nose. It's not an upgrade. And you have a choice between a roast beef sandwich that you wouldn't give to a prisoner, let's say, in Mississippi in the 50s wouldn't eat this. It's like congealed roast beef. I'm afraid to go to the bathroom on a plane for fear I'll be arrested. Let's say the bathroom's, busy, the middle one, and you're, afraid to go now to the front bathroom near the pilot's door. I'm afraid they think I'm a terrorist. I swear to God, it's like I don't want to sit next to a young child. She could say I touched her. You can get arrested just for sitting next to him. I don't want him near me. Get him away from me. Don't bring no kid near me. I don't want to know them. Don't even bring him near me. Don't put him in a chair next to me. Her mother could say I looked at her wrong. You could wind up in jail for 90 years. Same thing with the bathroom. They put it, it was always on those planes, 757s. They're right next to the pilot's locked door, right? So if you go in that little, channel there between the kitchen area and the pilot's door, you have to literally go in that alleyway toward the pilot's door to get into the toilet. At that point, my heart starts to race that like a marshal could jump up and hit me over that and take me to a chair. because they thought I was going to the pilot's door. It's so crazy. No wonder the woman went nuts at the airport. It could happen to any of us. It's a sad story, that one. What happened to her? What do you think happened to that poor woman, Gottbaum? You know, I mean, I didn't even talk about that story, about the Gottbaum story. The woman, she was going to alcohol treatment, Arizona. Okay, she had trouble with drinking. That's not a crime. Millions of people do. So then, okay, so she goes nuts at the airport. She gets there late for the flight. She becomes hysterical, starts causing a disturbance. Why did they have to shackle her? I don't get that part of it. Can anyone explain to me why they had to treat her like that? What, was she an animal? Now, there was a problem, number one, in how they constrained her. She was not an animal. She was a distressed woman. They overreacted to do this to her. And what it did is it caused a panic in her. But, and here's a big but, the family was wrong, too. If she was A, suicidal, as they are saying, and B, going to treatment, they should have accompanied her, or the clinic should have sent an attendant to be with her. She never should have been on that plane alone. That's A. However, what happened to her is what frightens all of us at airports today. There's an overkill. She was a white middle-class woman who was obviously not a terrorist. They treated her as though she was, you know, one of the 19 hijackers about to take down the airport. They had no right to do that to her. There's something wrong with this picture. I don't know how she could have strangled herself. Truthfully, I can't figure it out. How could she have strangled herself in that room? Although I did see it. They cuff her behind the back. They shackle her feet like an animal. You hear, like an animal in a concentration camp. And then they put a stainless steel wire on the back of her handcuffs to a table. So she panicked. It's like an animal will panic, and an animal can hurt itself. A racehorse, for example, in a starting gate. Sometimes a thoroughbred will get hurt in a starting gate at a racetrack if it's a really highly spirited, high strung, if you want to put it to you that way, horse. When that starting bell rings and the gate opens, some horses will hurt themselves, or some will bang themselves against the stall before the opening. They get so nervous. So there are high-strung people. Why must they be treated when they make a little mistake like they're Yusuf Ibrahim about to blow up the World Trade Center?
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. To an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
And now on to the Savage Nation. 1-800-449-8255. Debbie, KNEW San Francisco, go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. How do you do? Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Savage, I do suffer from psychological and psychiatric illness, and I denied it for many, many years, having heard stories of my grandmother in New York, who at a mummer's parade had just been released from a psychiatric hospital and was a little too happy, so was returned by black wagon to suffer another round of electroshock therapy. So growing up, when I myself found myself to suffer from similar symptomologies, refused to go get help. And I'll tell you, I do believe that humans, and I find it interesting that rather than recognizing that we do produce very...
All right, so but what is your main point? Of course there's mental illness. There's always been, you know, marginally crazy people and overtly crazy people. We know that. So what is it that we're disagreeing on?
Well, I think it's not subjective, sir. I think that there is a scientific way of producing diagnoses by way of examining common symptomologies and behavior.
Well, it's not that precise. That's the point. And that's where the rub lies. The doctors would have you believe that it's easy to diagnose and definitively diagnose at that mental illness. And I disagree entirely. It's not that easy. Now, I've seen brain scan studies. Don't get me wrong. I've seen the different colorations in schizophrenics and others. But we have no fundamental argument here. In other words, I know there are people who are unstable. I know there are people who are totally crazy. And I know people who are rock steady and never suffer any such orientation. So where the argument arises is, can we control some of these proclivities through means other than medication? Is the only argument that I think we're having.
Well, I definitely think it can be controlled through medication. The disappointment.
No, you didn't hear me. You see, you went right over what I said. I said, can some of these symptoms or conditions be controlled with means other than medication?
I think it depends to what extent an individual is suffering. In my case, the answer is no. I spent many, many years seeking out. I went to Marin County. I saw the best nutritional therapist, and I wish I could say their names on air.
Did you try mega doses? Well, I'm going to pick one thing out of the air. Did you try massive doses of niacin?
Sir, I tried niacin until my skin was so red. I look like
I'm only asking because I want to know how far you went along with nutritional therapies. Of course, they're not going to work in all cases, but you did try Dr. Hoffer's niacin therapy.
I had more niacin in my blood. I went to Oregon. I went to L.A. I had neurosurgery for a very bizarre,
They looked at your iron levels. They looked at your folic acid levels, correct?
Everything. I had more blood panels drawn from me.
You went that route. The route didn't help you, and now you're on major antipsychiatric drugs, and you feel better, correct?
I absolutely feel better, and I've been on
Fine. Well, no one's arguing with that. But I'm saying don't put children on Ritalin the minute they show signs of being a boy.
I absolutely agree with that as well.
All right, so there's no argument. You'll get me crazy if I keep talking to you another three minutes. Three more minutes, I'll need to reach for a pill. 1-800-449-8255. You can get me. You go crazy from it. I once went and visited a holy man, a religious teacher. He was a former pugilist, a boxer, who then went into religion and became a religious guy. But he still maintained the man of the street. He knew reality. In other words, he didn't come from like an effete background. I was suffering at the time through various things that were going on in my life, mainly societal social engineering that made me feel like a failure because I was not granted what I had earned because they wanted to put people with less qualifications and of other races and of other sexual orientations. Total morons, by the way, given jobs, which is why the university has fundamentally collapsed in America in many departments, certainly not in all. And I was feeling it. I had two young children. I didn't know what was wrong. I killed myself. I did great work. I published my dissertation at a Harvard University Journal. I mean, it was pretty good stuff that I did. And they hired whack job moron feminist tree huggers or people from countries of origin other than the United States of America to make them feel good and to look good on the brochures. So I go to see this holy man, and he says to me, what is exactly your problem? And I explain it to him. And he says to me, you know, we have a saying which says that if you take a stick and you put it into a dog, he used the word, I can't say it, let's say dog waste, I'll put it that way on the show. And he says, no matter which way you turn the stick, it's still dog waste. And he said, now, if you don't mind, I have to excuse myself right now. I got very mad at him. I was fuming because I wanted some mystical experience in this holy man's office. He told me if you take a stick and you put it in, you know what, and no matter how you move the stick around, it's still you know what. What he was telling me is stop moving the stick around and you know what. And he was right. See, so there are many ways to cure problems. They're not all medicatable. Not everything needs medication. Sometimes common sense works. That's what I'm trying to tell you, is that there's an epidemic of loss of common sense. An epidemic of loss of common sense. We have a nation of ninnies. Everyone walks around, medication. I want my medication. I want my crutch. I want my drug. I want my medication. I want Uncle Sam to pay for my medication. I'm sickly. I want my drug. Well, maybe you need your drug and maybe you don't. Maybe you're just a weak individual who refuses to take control of your own life. You know, you have diabetes and you're still eating Krispy Kreme. I wouldn't give you medication. I'd make you pay for your medication if you refuse to modify your diet. And you want me to pay for your diabetic treatment, for your treatment for diabetes, and so forth and so on. If you're not willing to help yourself, why should I help you? That's why our taxes are out of control in this country. But more than that, psychiatry is often used as mind control, societal control in our country. And I want to make a very big political point now, because we're moving very, very close to the ex-Soviet Union, where psychiatrists were used to diagnose people who were antisocial or anti-political. They were then taken away by the secret police, medicated into submission, and thrown into re-education camps. If you think we're not moving in that direction, my friend, you are mistaken. Some well-meaning psychiatrists are this far away from recommending that political dissidents in this country not be medicated. Trust me on this. I'm sure it's being discussed. that anyone who suffers this phobia or that phobia can only be treated with major pharmaceuticals. And I can guarantee you, as I sit here, that it's going to come from the homosexual radical community, that Christians who believe in the Word of God are psychiatrically impaired by definition, and they should be medicated, and they should be reeducated. That is the only way to cure them of their God madness. I can guarantee you it's being whispered in psychiatric halls. So don't tell me I don't see what's coming in this country unless you stand up to this juggernaut of the medico-legal profession, the medico-pharmaceutical legal profession, because they're all intimately involved. Now, that's not to throw away all of medicine. That would be foolish. And I've never said that. That would be a ridiculous thing to say. I'm talking about integrative medicine, where all of these modalities are work together. You don't jump to one or the other. That would be like saying, oh, let's never use drugs and let's only use dietetics. That's absurd in most cases. So don't think that I'm a zealot in one area. But I don't want to be led around by the nose and to believe that there are no effects upon mind and body other than those that can be cured by drugs. The drug establishment is out of control in its power over the mind of the people. Take a look at the Viagra ads. I turned on Fox, CNN, MSNBC. I flipped around at 15 minutes after the hour all day. All I saw was a white-haired man dancing a woman around on a floor with a big smile as they left to the hotel room and said, Viagra, Viagra, Viagra. Every channel at 15 after the hour. Every man needs Viagra over the age of 40, according to the advertisements. Could it be that the man is impotent? Excuse me, erectile dysfunctional because he really doesn't want to have sex because he's not in heat? We are the only animal on earth who is deluded by our societal images and pressures into thinking that we should be, wow, I'm raring to go 365 days a year. I can spring up like a 15-year-old. I'm a potent man. There's no animal on earth that is potent 365 days a year. We're the only animal who's been deluded into thinking we should be. So now we medicate the fact that we're not attracted to the woman. We're out of sync with the desire. Or we shouldn't be having sex at all right now. Why must a man have sex 365 days a year? Where have you read an animal that has sex 365 days a year? It's unheard of. So in a sense, we are a totally insane society being led around by our nose. Indianapolis, George, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, how are you? Hello.
Next case, off the air. Let me explain the rules again. When you get on the show, don't ask me how I am, please. I won't take your call. I'm a rude guy. I don't want you to ask me out. You know, when I listen to talk radio driving in a car, the local yokels do this. Hey, Bob, how are you? Good, John. How are you? Fine. Good. What are you calling about, Bob? Uh-huh. Out. Off. I'm listening to Mantovani music at that point. Anything. I'm listening to Mexican love songs. I'm listening to baseball. Anything. I'm the button scanning. Hi, you're on WBZD. How are you? Good. It's not CB radio. I'm not in a truck. I'm not Breaker One here. It's a radio show. National radio. Get up there and say your piece. I'm going to try it again. Akron, Ohio. John, here comes the Nazi of our time. Go ahead, John. You got the floor. You got a minute.
Yes, I don't believe in the Holocaust, and I'm an educated professional, too. So what are you trying to say? It's all ignorant people. I don't believe
yes,
in
yourself. Your education has been blinded by your hatred for Jews. How could you not believe in what something is documented? How could you not believe in a fact of reality? It's like saying, I don't believe in the moon.
Just because you say it so must make it so, even though there's no evidence.
Listen, you piece of garbage, you. Listen, you piece of crap. Everybody knows that 6 million Jews were killed and 6 to 7 million Christians. Just because an ignorant fool like you, who was raised by a Nazi swine in Akron, Ohio, doesn't believe in it, doesn't make you right, you fool, you. You Nazi-loving freak.
Well, you can call me all the names you want. It doesn't change.
Yeah, I'll call you all the names I want. That's right. And what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it, you piece of garbage? What's the matter? You never saw the death camp footage?
Propaganda.
So, in other words, people created the footage. That was created in 1945 by the American military who opened up the doors of Auschwitz. The U.S. military created it?
No, it's people who died of disease and starvation towards the end of the war. That's all the footage. There's no footage of people, and there's no.
Who was it who poisoned you? Was it your mother or your father that was the Nazi?
Well,
which one? Was it the mother or the father that poisoned your little brain? Was your mother deprived of folic acid when she was... was she the alcoholic while you were in the womb, or was it your father? who beat you with a big German strap?
Neither.
Was it your mother's deficient diet that starved your neural tube of folic acid that created a hater like you?
That must be the reason.
Yep, that must be the reason. I'm reading Healing Children Naturally to see if I can diagnose better the Nazi's deficiencies, how he got that way. And I'm looking on the folic acid. I'm not sure if it was a folic acid deficiency of his mother that caused his neural tube to have these defects, or it was a lack of another B vitamin. I'm going to have to look it up on page 17 and see what has created the Nazi brain. Consequences of deficiencies during pregnancy. Mother may be harmed. While the nutrients that are needed by the child must come from the mother's food, the developing embryo may draw them, if necessary, from the mother's tissues, even at the expense of the mother's nutritional status. So you see, the Nazi's mother obviously was nutritionally deficient, and the deficiency was so great from eating all of that worst product and eating the kraut that apparently her food habits were so deficient that with the alcoholic husband that she had who beat her son after he was born, these borderline deficiencies produced such a disastrous manifestation that we could have a moron call the show and say that the footage of Auschwitz that was shot by the U.S. military as they invaded the camps and freed the people from the ovens was created by the U.S. military. Then when you catch him on that, the Nazi says, well, no, they just died of typhus. See, this is what happens. The virulence of Jew hatred in this country is being flared up by this Iranian Hitler. So he's already done his damage. I'll be right back.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show. Savage. You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
So what do you want to talk about? Anything here? Rob, WOR, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Dr. Savage, sometimes I got to be honest with you. You give me the creeps. It sounds like God speaks right through your mouth. It's unbelievable. But I'll tell you this. You should be concerned about what Coulter said, because there is a contamination within modern Christianity today. And there are a lot of Christians that believe somehow the Jewish people have been forsaken and they have, you know, taken their place. And that is incredibly erroneous, especially when Jesus Christ made it very clear in the New Testament that all Gentiles were grafted into the olive branch, which any biblical student would know are the Jewish people. If anything, Christ called that we protect all the Jewish people, provide with them financially, spiritually, even lay down our lives. It's very...
Rob, you know, you're a brilliant man, and I want to go back to what you said at the beginning. It was a little garbled, but I heard it, and I want the people to hear it. You said something about her contaminating the dialogue. Please explain that.
Absolutely. I think that within the Christian church today, what a lot of Christians have come to know, they're aware of this, it's called replacement theology, and that's this idea that after the Jewish temple, King Solomon's temple, was destroyed in 70 AD, that this was like the final climax and really the end of the Jewish blessing, that the Christians, that the Gentiles of today and then a few hundred years ago and so forth, have now been given God's blessing, Jesus Christ's blessing. And if anything, the Bible isn't very clear that the only people ever guaranteed salvation are the Jewish people, you know, without any kind of preconditions set forth for the Gentiles. The Gentiles have to, they've been given salvation, they've been grafted into the salvation plan by the mercy of God through the Jewish people. We owe the Jewish people everything, Dr. Savage. And it's foolish for Gentiles.
So, do you agree with my historical reference when I say that there were once three branches of Judaism with three sects known as the Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes? Every educated Christian knows that. And that from this last sect, the Essenes, came a new Jewish sect known as the Christians. That is an historic fact, correct?
Absolutely, 100% accurate.
All right, but this is something that an educated Christian knows. It's the uneducated, axe-wielding, drunken louts who apparently now have a skirt to speak for them who think that Jews are imperfect Christians.
Absolutely, and that's the arrogance within the Christian community that's very ignorant of what even biblical scripture has to say about that entire concept. The whole issue of Jews accepting Jesus Christ, that's a whole other separate issue that God will deal with himself, but in no way, shape, or form does that diminish the fact that we are required to, without question, walk in lockstep with the Jewish people. That's why no Christian should be supporting this roadmap to peace. It's a suicide mission. It's anti-biblical in every way, shape, and form. It's a disgrace, Dr. Savage.
Rob, I wish you were my friend, and I wish we could have a drink together. And I don't say that too often on this show. I don't know what to say to you other than God bless you and thank you for calling the program. Yes, the man has said it correctly. The Hague is contaminating the dialogue between Christians and Jews. Don't you understand this, what this does? You start out with making jokes like this, the Jews are imperfect Christians. What do you think that translation is inside the head of a drunken lout who comes out of a bar and passes a synagogue? And tell me what that is. Are you proud of the fact that you are probably going to provoke violence in this world? It's unbelievable to me. WTNT, boy, we're getting them all out of Washington today. Mike, welcome to the Savage Nation. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
It's good to talk to you. What really I enjoy the best about your show is when you go into the stories of one-armed Frank and, you know, growing up in the five boroughs. We had a Tom the Bum and young kids running down the subway. We learned charity from Tom the Bum.
Hold it. You're going to tell us a story. Quick, Tom the Bum. I'm listening.
Okay, Tom the Bum, he had one arm also, and he would stay in the subways, and our mothers used to, you know, he was like the horror show. He used to run down there, run on the other side.
Yeah, all right, so, right, you went down to see him, it was like a Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Right, but your mother would send you down there with food, and you'd, like, push the food with your foot, and you'd say, hey, Tom, eat this, because he was an alcoholic, you know, but he had one.
Oh, but you didn't want to actually touch him. That was absolutely, because you could get leprosy.
You don't know what you're going to get. You know, you're scared, you're a little kid. But, you know, we learned charity with this guy. Tom the Bum was one of the best surgeons in the neighborhood. He cut his arm off because he lost a patient, and he became an alcoholic.
Wait a minute. Did you just make that up?
No, this is not. This is true, Mike. This is true. Tom the Bum.
What do you mean? He was a doctor who lost a patient, and he hated himself and cut his arm off?
Became an alcoholic and cut his arm off, and he lived in the subways. So we had to take care of him.
He sounds like a saint. The guy's like a saint, the story.
You know, but that's where we learn charity. You know, like these one-armed Franks, Tom the Bum. We all have stories. But it's the greatest thing to turn on the radio, hear the music, think about the old stories, you know, the 50s.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language. Adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Question is this. Do you still go to museums, or have museums become museums in the United States of America? I went to the DeYoung Museum in San Francisco. I haven't been there, and I must have been 5 or 6 years. I used to live in museums. I grew up in an antique store. I grew up looking at art, and I spent a lot of time in museums. I always have. But I stopped going years ago when San Francisco's collections started to be dominated by the AIDS racketeers, and they started to turn everything in museums into a sort of plea for a special subpopulation of the American people. And I couldn't take it anymore, and I stopped going. And then every exhibit was so PC, you know, this and that and that and that. But, you know, I said, wait a minute. Although they have destroyed the museums to a great extent with this politically expedient dreck, AIDS art and art from every little subculture in the world. They put a basket from Guatemala next to a Rembrandt, and they tell you they're culturally equal. You hear? Nevertheless, the European collections are still there, and they still stand out, and they are still worth going to see. So let me begin at the end. I leave the museum after 2 hours, and I come out feeling enlightened. And I use the word enlightened in the way it truly was written and meant to be understood. I felt lighter inside. My spirit was lifted from association with great art. I stood nose to nose with Hopper and with Church and with other great European artists. You know, an inch from the oil paint is an astonishing thing to behold. And you can literally feel the movements of the brush. And it does something to your mind that you can't compare with anything else, certainly not television or movie. So I saw some of my favorite old paintings, and they were amazingly fabulous. And I just love the intelligent young families with young children, mainly Europeans, I must tell you, sadly. Very few American families, mainly French families with their kids. They still take their young children to the museums, as I did with my children. But I'll tell you what I'm here to talk about, not museums so much. I'm going to talk about Ajenta. Now, Ajenta is a busybody in American slang. There's an exhibit in the museum that is just breathtakingly, frighteningly hard to believe it's in a museum. It's their lead exhibit. It's called Nan Kempner, American Chic. I have to read you the press release. The native San Franciscan's famous style comes to the Young Museum. So I said, this can't be. They cannot be doing this. But yes, they were doing it. Here's a woman I never heard of. She died in 2005, I learned when I went there. And her dresses were in showcases. But wait, it gets worse. There was a whole glass case devoted to this woman's shoes. Her shoes. So I stood there laughing out loud. People thought I was crazy in the museum. And I said, by God, it's every Yenta's dream. There they are, the Yenta's shoes under glass in a museum after she's dead. So a guard came over to me and he said to me, he whispered, he said, you're 100% right. He said, don't tell anyone I said so. He couldn't believe it. I said, in all the years you've been in a museum, have you ever seen a woman's shoes put on display in a showcase? He said, never. So I said, this exhibit is the ultimate nothing. It's the ultimate nothing. I got to read you the press release from a museum that still has some of the finest art in the world. And you have to ask yourself, who is in charge of our museums that they would put a woman's dresses in the showcase and her shoes? Well, wait, let me just read this campy stuff to you. When I read the word the native San Franciscan's famous style, first of all, the first word that offends me is the word native. So far as I know, she's not of Miwok heritage. I don't understand why people who are so out of town as native San Franciscans make such an issue of being native San Franciscans. What does that mean? What does that qualify you for? Why is that special? What do you mean native? What does that mean anymore? So I'll read this to you. The style of Nan Kempner, noted fashion icon, couture connoisseur, San Francisco native, and member of the Best Dressed List Hall of Fame, will be shown at the Young Museum this summer. Now, by the way, this exhibit started in New York, by the way. It was first shown in New York, so don't think it's just this out-of-town group of closet hacks here. She started collecting couture clothing 50 years ago when she was a young woman living in San Francisco. In other words, she was a wastrel living on her father's money and her husband's money, probably did nothing in her life except wear clothing. Now, I'm editorializing, mind you. This is my opinion. This is a press release for a major museum in the United States of America in the year 2007. This is what it's come down to with the assault upon our institutions in this country by the illegitimate left. This is the kind of garbage they're showing. So I'll read on now. At the time of her death, she owned one of the foremost private couture collections in the country with garments from Yves Saint Laurent, whose real name is probably Hyman Shapiro, Valentino, whose real name is probably Maxi Rosenberg, and Oscar de la Yenta, whose real name is probably Hyman Rabinowitz, in her closet. Nan Kempner, American Chic, displays nearly 75 of the thousands of ensembles and accessories she possessed. Can you believe this? More than 25 of the garments are exclusive to the de Young exhibition. The late fashion editor and arbiter, Diana Vreeland, said, there's no such thing as a chic American woman. The one exception is Nan Kempner. This exhibition displays Kempner's seemingly effortless chic style. Blah, 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 blah. Now, listen to this. I'm telling you, this is in an American museum next to paintings by Hopper, paintings by Church, paintings by the most genius artists of our historical past. They put a Yenta's clothing in a showcase. Quote, Nan Kempner's eclectic style was uniquely American. She was known for putting couture jackets with Levi's blue jeans. It's a common practice today, but back when she started doing it, it was revolutionary, close quote, says John E. Buchanan Jr., director of the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. Fashion is one of the earliest forms of self-expression. Nan Kempner was one of those people who made dressing and fashion an art form. And on, you get the picture? And then they quote, they say, Nan always looked so wonderful in my clothes because she had a body like a hanger. The thin, elegant blonde was said to be the inspiration for the term social X-ray in Tom Wolfe's novel Bonfire of the Vanities. In addition to her fondness for shopping, let me pause there. So in other words, here's a woman who did nothing in her life but be a parasite on her father and her husband and wear clothing, and she had a fondness for shopping. Kempner was known for her sharp wit and love of parties. You hear? Now listen to what passes for sharp wit amongst the closet people here. You know me, she once said. I'd go to the opening of a door. Symbol shot. Nan Kempner, American chic, originated at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, New York, the San Francisco presentation of the Young Museum was sponsored by Merrill Lynch. The ultimate nothing now on exhibit. And I could not believe that this is what has become considered worthy of showing in our museums. How did this happen to American culture? Answer. Would you like to give me the answer, or would you like Mike to give you the answer? Now remember, I grew up in museums. I spent many a happy rainy day playing hooky from jobs and from various other places at the Metropolitan Museum in New York. Thousands of hours in the Metropolitan, wandering before it became a zoo, wandering alone on rainy Wednesdays or Tuesdays or Thursdays in soiled raincoats, wandering the endless halls before it filled up with the Euro trash and the school buses. I'll be right back.
Yeah. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. To an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Portland, Oregon, Alan, KXL, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I made an observation, and the show was a repeat about a week ago. It went to commercial, and after coming back from commercial, I didn't get to hear your explanation because it changed topics, and the observation had to do between the relationship of the perspective of a child and the elderly. And I also wanted to let you know that that's right in line with Einstein's theory of special relativity, stating basically that time was relative.
You're a very brilliant man, but I have to ask you to repeat the question. You're asking me to tell you what I think about perceptions of reality, the difference of perceptions of reality of a child and an adult, or a child and an old person?
You made an observation, and I've made the same observation, where I think you were sitting on your boat, and you said it kind of hit you that when you're a child, everything has a kind of a grand, big, bigger-than-life kind of feel to it. And then when you get maybe like I'm in my 30s, where everything becomes really mundane. And then
how a child sees the world. Well, I have a dog who has to substitute for a child, and so his perceptions are different than a child's, but you watch a dog react to things, and you see to a dog every sound is bigger than life, okay? It's the same to a child. To a child, it's all brand new. So what can you imagine what a rainbow must look like to a child? And as we get older, rainbows still inspire most of us, but we're somewhat jaded. I think that's what you're referring to, that kind of gross interpretation.
It is, but you said the observation was you start to get some of that back. I mean, as time goes on, you start to, you know, smell the roses.
Oh, you're saying that as you get older, some of it comes back? Maybe I was in one of those moods for a minute. Maybe I don't know why it hit me. You're saying that I said that I was feeling some of those things I felt as a child again?
Correct. I mean, that's what you were saying.
Could have been I had enough B3 that day. I don't really know. I don't have any explanation. It could have been the niacin.
But I mean, but that is right in line with Einstein's special theory of relativity, where he basically
How so? What does he say?
He basically boils it down to where he's basically stating that time's relative. It's relative to the perspective of the person watching the train versus the person on the train.
There's another analogy which my friend, a physicist, repeated on radio last week, where he said the issue of monkeys on a typewriter. You know, monkeys are dancing on the keys of a typewriter and letters are typed, and people think that the monkeys are typing the letter. But in fact, they're just randomly dancing on the keys of a typewriter. Does that more or less fit?
No, I'm not really sure if that's really what I'm trying to convey, but...
Let's take the analogy of monkeys dancing on the keys of a typewriter. That would be the news people today, the journalists. That because they're typing letters that are somewhat literate, meaning that they're spelled correctly and they make sentences, they think that they're writing the news. But it has no relationship to what the news really is.
I do agree.
Or let's go back to Plato, where Plato said most of us don't see reality, we only see the shadows on the wall. Does that work for you?
That's closer. Like I said, it was just an explanation of an observation you made. I do remember being a child. I do remember every once in a while.
Oh, you're saying because I said that you were able to relate back to being a child yourself and remember what it was like to be a child. I think most of us occasionally, when we're super relaxed and we're really in a state of calm, we can sometimes look back and look for a moment the way we saw it. We can see the world as we did as a child. I think that's true. I don't know what to say on that. I think it does happen, you know, to people. I don't know. Sometimes I say things on the show and I can't remember saying them and I can't recall what I said. You know, you talk about 15 years of conversation. I wish I could have that kind of recall. I don't. I'm very lucky, though. We have good archives, the crew for my show. Phil and Beowulf, I mean, they're really great guys, and they can almost access anything immediately. If I say, do you remember when blah, 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 they can hit? It's not yet that well organized, but they know it by now. They know me very, very well. I have to thank them for that. Guys, do you know what he's referring to? I wish you could find it for me for tomorrow. Ottawa, Tom, you're on the Savage Nation topic, please.
Yeah, I'm calling to support your debunking global warming piece that you have on your homepage. I've worked with hundreds of climate scientists for the last 10 years, in many countries, and quite frankly, there is no consensus about the causes of climate change. A lot of the stuff that we hear, unfortunately, in the press tells us that there's this consensus, and so many of the scientists are actually very reluctant to speak out. But, you know, what you're doing and what others are doing are hopefully creating a climate where more scientists can actually say what they're really finding.
Yes, it's a little site on michaelsavage.com, which is called Debunking Global Warming, and the headline says, less than half of published scientists endorse global warming theory. That doesn't stop charlatans like Al Gore from saying virtually all scientists agree. It doesn't stop politicians like Jerry Brown, the attorney general of the state of California, going on NPR 2 weeks ago and infuriating me by saying all scientists agree that global warming is real and it's caused by man, and we now have to constrain industry in the hands of government. And they don't permit anyone on NPR to get up there and say, now, wait a minute. Less than half of published scientists endorse global warming theory. It's amazing, the big lie. But then, as Goebbels said, when you tell a big lie often enough, it becomes the truth. Right now, the liberals are telling the big lie, and they've turned it into a half-truth, which they take as the whole truth.
And I'm saying to media that frequently bring this up, I'm saying, prove it. Show us that there is a consensus in the climate science community. And they can't do it because there is no worldwide poll, and the IPCC only represents a very small fraction of the world's scientists. So,
right.
In fact,
and you know, one of the best, I got to tell you this, one of the best, you could take the average person who doesn't know science, and if you go on to Greenland Ice Yields Hope on Climate, to me, that was one of the most important recent discoveries, yet it's never been broadcast by the media. It was an international team of scientists, multinational team of scientists. They worked for years. You know the one. They bored 1.2 miles into the Greenland ice shelf. They pulled up the remnants, the DNA of plants and animals that lived eons ago. And guess what they discovered? The Earth was warmer eons ago than it is today. How can they then say that it's we causing this uptick in global warming? There may be an uptick in global warming, but it's not we who are doing it. That is not to argue that I like pollution. I hate pollution. I'm a boater. I'm a hiker. I'm an outdoorsman. I despise people who poison the air, waters, and places. But I also despise liars who try to constrain to gain control of every aspect of industry around the Western world under the guise of global warming in order to simply induce a soft market Marxism. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
I don't want to sound like one of those ancient preachers that ran around saying, you know, repent, the world is coming to an end. Or do I want to quote the second coming from William Butler Yeats about the beast slouching toward Bethlehem waiting to be born? But on the other hand, this is a very spiritual time on the Jewish calendar. It's going to be a very spiritual time on the Muslim calendar when Ramadan begins tomorrow in some places, in other places it begins today because of their interpretation of the lunar calendar. And so consequently, a big part of me, I think, moves with the tides of the ancients. How do you think? Let me just do something I don't think I've ever done before. How do you think an unknown man rose to this position of prominence in the media without any support whatsoever from the media? It's almost unheard of. Now, there are others who are more popular than I and bigger than I, but they have a huge machine behind them. They have a powerful network behind them with unlimited publicity and the benefits thereof. And it's good to have. There's nothing wrong with that. How is it that an unknown man, Michael Savage, could write four books in a row, each one of which winds up on the New York Times bestseller list? And I don't hold up the New York Times as the arbiter of what's good or what's bad, only that it's a yardstick of a certain amount of commercial success on a serious level. How did this happen? Do you think it's simply based upon my talent, my drive, my genius, some would say, or is it based upon something else? Do you think that there's another hand involved? Do you think, as Rocky Graziano said in his great autobiography, Someone Up There Likes Me? I mean, that was a beautiful title. I remember I met the champ a long time ago, and his energy was, it was actually frightening to be in his presence. I got to tell you, I was actually at his daughter's first wedding, or wedding. I don't know if she got married since. She actually married an old friend of mine. And he was there, and Rocky was, he was like a rock, this guy. He was quiet, he was dignified, but he projected a strength and an energy that would really make the average man take note. That's all I can tell you. I was a kid. I don't know how old I was, 20. I have no idea. But you know, when you grow up seeing a guy who is mythological and then you're in the room with him, you have to say to yourself, my God, this is unbelievable. But he was just as I thought he would be, overly powerful, bigger than life. And he was Italian Catholic. And his daughter married a Jewish guy, and they were married by a rabbi. I'll never forget this as long as I live. They were married in a rabbi's office. There were only four people present. Rocky, the daughter, the groom, and myself, and the rabbi. And I don't know what, but Rocky said something to the rabbi who was marrying his daughter. He said something about the Rock of Ages, put his hand on the Bible, and he smiled. And boy, I don't know, I got some kind of energy out of that. But then he had written an autobiography years later called Somebody Up There Likes Me. It became a movie. It was a fabulous, popular novel. He was saying he derived his strength and his faith and his success from God. Now, when do you hear this anymore? Where in the world do you hear this anymore? It is snuffed out. It's laughed out by the demonic elements in the media. The minute anybody says that, the jackals jump on him and say they make a mockery of him. Look at these schmucks like Bill Maher, these disgraced snakes, these asps in the media who mock everybody who's decent and everything that's decent. Look how high they've risen. And then look at the perverts behind them. Look who runs these agencies. You look at the talent agencies. I had a brief interchange with a talent agency. I will not divulge what I learned, but I can guarantee you that everything I feared was much worse than I feared. And so every disgusting image that you see that's generated into your head is calculated by these devils. Every image that is permitted to get out is calculated by these devils. And anything good is either snuffed out or laughed out by these freaks. So that's why I say to you, you'll have to forgive me today because I'm in one of these rare weirdo moods. And I have to step into my own shoes. And I can't hide it anymore. I have to step into my own shoes. I can't continue to deny what's obvious to many of you and isn't even obvious to me, that I won't let be obvious to me. I have to step into my own shoes. This can't have happened by accident. It's impossible that I reach millions of people without any support whatsoever from the media, without any publicity whatsoever, banished and banned by Fox News, banished and banned by every newspaper in the country, banished and banned by God knows everybody in the media, never spoken about the unspoken Michael Savage, just as they used to do in Stalin's time. They would exile people whose ideas they didn't like by not talking about them. The Izvestia or Pravda newspaper, The Truth in the ex-Soviet Union, had a small group of editors, and they knew who to deny the existence of. Solzhenitsyn didn't exist. They couldn't mention his name. If they did, they got fired. Today, Savage can't be mentioned. I'm not putting myself in Solzhenitsyn's boots. I don't want to be in his boots. He was a great writer and a great man, and I hope to God I never have to suffer the exile he suffered and live in the Gulag Archipelago. It's bad enough being banished to the world I'm in, but I take great strength in it as well. Solitude is not so bad. On the other hand, I got to tell you that this is not by accident. You think it's just the gift of gab? What do you think, I'm just entertaining? You think this would happen if I was just ha-ha-ho-ho-hee-hee-ho-ho after 15 years of a show? Why would people take time out of their day? The show hasn't declined, it's risen. Why would people take time out of their day? And since I've started, the choices are even greater than they were 2 years ago. Everybody's a conservative talk show host, but none of them are conservative, you understand. They're all independent conservatives. They're all independent conservatives. None of them back Bush. They all are independent-minded. Every one of them is a combination of Einstein and Copernicus with a little Spinoza thrown in, mixed with Rocky Marciano. So with all of this competition, you'd think my show would diminish if it was by accident. It didn't. It grew bigger. So what I'm saying is there's another element here. It's the unknown element. It's the mysterious element of success that no one can write about. Now, there are many books written about how to succeed, and some of them have a meaning. I found most of them to be rubbish. The people I've known who've made fortunes never read a book on how to make a fortune. Not one person who I know personally is a wealthy man, and I know quite a few, and I mean wealthy. I'm not talking about a million-dollar fortune. We're talking about 100 million plus. I know a few. I know a few with over $1 billion. Not too many, but they built it on their own on a card table. Never read a book on how to become rich. Never read a book on how to win friends and influence people. Never. There's always another element. And you know, I when I was in graduate school earning my PhD, I'll never forget, one of the gentlemen on my thesis committee was an MD. Actually, three of them were. One of them was a medical doctor who said to me that he's been at many autopsies or performed many autopsies where the man died of a heart attack and the arteries were perfectly clear. And he said, there's always a mysterious element in health and disease. He said, there's the unknown factor in health and disease. Now, you well know the power of prayer, although the media would, occasionally they throw you a bone. They give you the Reader's Digest view, which is that prayer helps healing. They got to throw it to you because they know you're the unwashed moronic cracker, not as smart as them. After all, you're not as smart as them to debase yourself the way they do, and you're sophisticated. They do things that their dog wouldn't do to each other, and you're just a cracker from the country. So once in a while, they say, well, those crackers believe in God and Jesus, so let's throw them a bone and say that the healing, that prayer helps healing. You know, make them feel good that we really believe it, Martha. But, you know, those of you who are not that cynical know that prayer has a great outcome. That's why you pray. That's why you go to church. There must be a reason it has been going on for so long. Sure, it's in decline, but why do you suppose the churches still have people who go in there on Sunday? Why do you suppose? You think they're doing it simply because they're supposed to do it? Well, in the case of children, yes. But why would so many intelligent, sophisticated adults go into a church, cross themselves, get on their knees, and pray to God? why would so many Jewish people who were so successful or so intelligent still get in there and say the prayers of the ancients going back to the Bible, putting on strange head coverings and phylacteries, following laws that are so difficult to follow? Why do they do it? Well, because they believe there's another presence other than Rupert Murdoch. They believe that there's a power greater than ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox News. They believe, in other words, in the spiritual world and in God. And so they try to pray to God. I once asked a religious leader, if God is so, when I was I was coming out of my atheistic phase, when I had turned my back on God completely and I almost wound up in hell. Maybe I was in hell. No, it couldn't be a real hell. Hell's got to be much worse. I was as close to hell as you can get and still be walking this earth. And I had to come back because I was so far down. There was no way to go but up. I had to bounce back up. Either it was that or it's over. But I had two young children. It couldn't be over. So somehow I found myself back talking to religious people, and I really went to the deepest element of the religious people I could find. And I once said to him, I was still cynical, though. I said to him, if God is so great, why does he need us to pray to him? And I'll never forget what this red-haired, rather feeble-looking biblical scholar told me. He said, Michael, he said, God doesn't need you to pray to him. He said, you need to pray to God. And in a minute, I understood it. Man has the need to worship God. In other words, inherent in mankind is the need to get down and to get down on his knees, if necessary, and understand there's a higher power than him. Now, it's the people get into trouble when they think that they're the sum total of all and better than everybody, and there's no one above them. You look at AA. What is AA built upon? Many of you may be ex-alcoholics and still not religious in a way, but you came out of the hell of drugs or alcohol addiction only when you realize you weren't God Almighty himself. Now, what do drugs and alcohol do for people? They take a person who thinks he's God Almighty with a crazed, out-of-control ego, narcissistic to the hilt. Most alcoholics are narcissistic. And when he wants to continue feeling like God, he has to have a bottle of booze, or he has to have that joint, or he has to have the pill or whatever, or the crank or whatever it may be. And you've got to keep dosing up, titrating towards God. You got to constantly titrate to be God. And eventually, of course, you can't titrate yourself up, and eventually you can't even sustain being an archangel. You can't even be a worm or an ant. And at that point, you have a couple of choices. What I'm getting at is it's only when you realize you're not God that you realize that you have a terrible, terrible aching need to worship. And I think that's why religion is sustained on the world today, whatever the religion may be, in whatever form it may take. Doesn't mean that you have to be in a house of worship. Many of you are religious in your own way, and you don't go to a house of worship. I know that. I think that my audience, being as independent politically as it is, would have to have an awful lot of people who may believe in God but don't go to a house of worship. That's what I would suspect. And in many ways, and here's the punchline. This show substitutes for the house of worship. That's right. I have become, in a strange way, the spiritual voice for millions of Americans who still have a taint of spirituality within them and have disconnected themselves from their religion. Now, that doesn't mean that super religious people don't listen. I know they do, because I meet them all the time. But I think that my largest audience consists of people who want to believe in something other than themselves. They know that there's something else out there, but they don't know how to do it. They don't know. They're too cynical. And so what do they listen to me for? Well, there's a number of reasons. I've been gifted with a great voice. I have a biblical level voice. I have almost a prophetic sounding voice. So that's a gift. I've had it since I'm like 12, adolescence. I remember when I was a kid and getting my voice, God willing, I maintained my voice. It's all in his hands. I remember how weird it was getting a man's voice. Has anyone ever talked about that? Going from being a pipsqueak kid, getting a man's voice, what it's like, how it almost frightens a child. I'll be right back to tell you about it.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
You know how I love my dog, Teddy, the 10-pound, 11-pound miniature poodle? He's like a piece of me, okay? I love the guy. Now, usually about 3 in the morning, he rustles around in the bed and he forces me to get up, which is convenient for a male, actually. I get up anyway, and he goes out in the garden. I stand there freezing or whatever. And let him back in, and then he goes back to sleep until we get up in the morning. But lately, I'm like on strike. I don't want to get up at 3 in the morning and stand there and watch him take a dump in the garden. So what I did last night was he started like rustling around 3 a.m. I knew what it meant, but I'm not in a great mood lately, and I wasn't able to get up for a damn dog and to go watch him, you know, stand in the garden there freezing. So I said, leave me alone, Teddy. Just do what you have. Just leave me alone. So he settled down. I figured, all right, I get up in the morning, everything's fine. And no sign of nothing, this and that. Then I put him in the garden. I see he's doing the circle thing and the squat that makes every dog look like freakish and ugly. And I turned away. I didn't want to see it. But I figured, all right, thank God he waited the night. But it was a slow day. Everything's starting slow. The coffee machine didn't work. That Italian machine, it makes noise and it comes up with, refer to manual and you call and talk to some kid in Newark with like a Rocky accent put in the filter. And I almost got scalded in my groin. I couldn't make coffee. I had to go back to the Sears $10 coffee machine. The white trash coffee cup worked fine. I go downstairs to my studio and boom, guess what Teddy had done? Crapped all over where I sit next to the microphone and the screens. He never did this. Of all the places in the house, look how smart they are and how they'll get even with you because I didn't take him out. He didn't go in a corner under a curtain. He didn't run to the back door and say, Dad, if you find this, it's because you were bad to me. He went downstairs in the dark of night, snuck into my studio where I broadcast from, or I'm sitting in front of the computer all day looking for idiotic stories to report on, and he all over the floor. And here, he's here with me now in the radio studio. I didn't hit him. I didn't yell. I just left. That's all. I packed up and got out of the house. And here I am at another house. So what am I going to do? What am I going to do with this world? The dog is even, he's even breaking down from the stress of this world. Who can take this? OR, New York City. Anita, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Dr. Michael Savage. How are you? I loved hearing about Teddy.
Well, but it's terrible. I mean, you know, my life with Teddy, here it is. It's the ups and downs. It's like a child, you know. But who expected him to pull that stunt on me?
When you speak of him, it sounds like a little child. He does.
But I call him, I don't know how to put it to you this way. When my children grew up and left, there was a vacuum in the house that's the only parents who've, you know, had a child and have raised the child. When the child leaves, there's a vacuum that enters your heart, your mind, and your soul that only a parent can appreciate. And that's the good news, meaning they go off to college or whatever. You know what I'm saying? God forbid you should lose a child. I can't imagine that hole. But the point I'm making is when you replace that loss or that emptiness with a dog, they really become like a child to you in a way, strangely enough. If you love animals, you don't have to become a sicko to take care of the child. He's in very many ways, he's like a two-year-old child.
Exactly. I love animals personally. Myself, I just love them.
Yeah. Well, do you love them when they crap on the floor under your desk? I don't.
Well, you just have to clean it up. I mean, that's what.
Ugh! I didn't clean it up. I ran out of the house. I think it's still waiting for me when I come home tonight. Kill him when I get there. He's sitting here looking at him, smiling. Makes believe he don't know from nothing. I didn't even hit him. What can you do after the fact? He knows what he did. He knows what he did. He did it because I wouldn't get up. So tonight I have a real dilemma. Now I won't even be able to fall asleep for fear that I'll fall asleep and I won't wake up. I don't know what he'll do next. No, I'm not going to let him train me. Never. I'll have to deal with this one in another way. I'd rather talk about poodle poop than Hillary Clinton. I would find it more interesting to analyze poodles and their poop habits than to talk about Democrats and Republicans, to be honest with you. That's how far it's fallen. I mean, I'm devolving. Maybe I'm devolving mentally from the stress of listening to this rubbish day in and day out. Joan, WOR, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael. It's such a pleasure to speak with you. We love you. You're brilliant, and you're so right about everything.
That's a nice opening. Who can disagree with you?
I know. I just had to call you because I had a poodle. Beauregard, and he lived till 15. But
oh, thank God.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Now, I got to tell you, a day in the life of a talk show host is ordinarily rather boring. So once in a while, I have to make sure it isn't boring. So here's what I did. It's like, why do I do this to myself? As I told you, I have several studios around the San Francisco Bay Area, and I shift around according to whim. So I go into the city. I want to see people. I want to have lunch in my favorite greasy spoon Chinese restaurant so I can complain about the indigestion. So I have a studio in an apartment building that's a nightmare, a mess, run by the most, well, just say run by morons. And they've been working on refurbishing the building for well over a year now, wrecking everybody's life with jackhammers and smoke and noise, and nobody can do anything about it because there's no power for a tenant in San Francisco unless you're a homeless bum with a needle sticking out of your arm. If you got a spike hanging out of your arm, you got the whole city behind you. If you're a normal tenant, you have no power whatsoever in this sicko city. So I figured they were through with the scaffolds outside my balcony. And I get there in the morning, and sure enough, there was no scaffold outside my balcony. It was like on the first floor. I said, all right, I picked a good day. I stroll around town. I look at this. I look at that. I go have lunch in my favorite greasy Chinese greasy spoon. I ate the whole plate of chicken curry, got nauseous from it, left, went out in the street like a dazed bumblebee had been sprayed with Raid, the way I wanted to feel, because I don't want to pay attention to the news. I amble over to an antique store, poke my head in, once in a while I enjoy it, and I found an RCA Victor composition advertising dog Nipper, circa 1950, height 36 inches. And I said, what a great idea. I think I'm going to buy the RCA Victor dog. It's like a ceramic statue. They want $1,295. Now, I grew up in the antique business. I figure it's worth $5. If an upscale antique store is asking $1,295, it must be worth between $5 and $10, I figure. Since I grew up in the antique business, I figured I'd go back and look it up on Google. Then I found another thing I wanted, an English or American mahogany decanter chest. Remember those chests? When I was a little kid, my father's store, these would come through. I love them. They're like a decanter chest with bottles called decanters that you put whiskeys in and various beautiful glasses circa 1810. And the price is $32.50. I figured I'd buy it. It's probably worth $250 on eBay. So I come home and I look up these items. Well, I didn't actually get I didn't finish the story yet. I put them in my bag, head back up to the apartment with about an hour to go before the show. And lo and behold, nightmare, the scaffold's outside my deck again with jackhammers going and smoke. I have to race up to the apartment, get my bag with stories, race down, jump in my car, which I call Kaiser Wilhelm. I gave it a name. And I have to race out of San Francisco, getting behind every tourist schmuck ever invented, six to a car, gaping, looking over the bridge, down and around, boom, boom, I'm home, 30 minutes, here I am, boom. So I look it up on the internet. And it's $99 for the dog. It's a little smaller, but it's $99, not $12.95. And the American or English mahogany decanter circa 1810 I can't find. And here I am, an English or American mahogany decanter chest containing six large and six small gilded decanters circa 1810. A guy wants $3,250. And the RCA Victor composition advertising dog Nipper circa 1950. They were... store wants $1,295. I'm trying to find it if I can buy it for less somewhere. I once was in the streets of North Beach, the once Italian district of San Francisco. Now it's the home to bums and mainland China, with a remnant of a Little Italy left to it, you know, somewhere. It's like sort of like the Little Italy amusement park, North Beach. But 30 years ago, when I first came to San Francisco, there used to be women dressed in black. Old, like, lean Italian women. They used to gossip with each other in the street, whispering. I loved it. And being the kind of guy I am, I would once in a while go up and talk to them. Because wherever I've been in the world, I've had the capacity to go up to strangers. And they, you know, I always get into good conversations for some reason. I don't know how the conversation arose. I was talking to one of the old women. She must have been a good 95. Gone, probably Sicilian. And I said to her, Mama, what do you do for health? I said to her, you know, like, she says to me, there's hardly anything that's wrong with a person that a little coffee, a little wine, and a little garlic can't cure. I agree with her 100%. I agree with 100%. Of course, I add a few things to that mixture. Like, it's not a little wine, it's more than a little wine. It's not a little garlic, it's a lot more than a little garlic. And there are other things I like to do, but for her at work, they were beautiful old women. They're gone. You don't see them anymore. I'm thinking of getting all 1950s items for a room, get 1950s clothing, like a bomb shelter. That isn't a bomb shelter. Just call it like a time shelter and go in it once a day. You know, like the advertising dog, Jack Benny, Bob Hope pictures. I just, another time, another world. It's crazy. The whole thing's nuts. I'm bored of it all. I know you are too. If I'm bored, you're bored. Or is it because you're bored, I'm bored? I mean, I can read the tea leaves. You don't survive in this business for as long as I have without feeling the national mood and sentiments. And I'm telling you that the people are turned off. The whole political structure is just in a world of its own. And there are many reasons for it, and there's no point in me insulting them. I do that on a regular basis. You know, I get insulted, they get insulted. What's the point? There's got to be something else we can do in talk radio until a dirty bomb goes off. I mean, there are... Isn't there something else us little people can talk about until a bomb? We wake up to a smoldering city, and the government agents running around in biohazard suits, telling us to remain calm, and to get on our hands and knees and pray to Mecca to show that we're in solidarity with our Muslim brethren, and if we don't, we'll be arrested. There must be something we can do until that day. The only way to make sense of a lot of things in this world is to put yourself in the position of the nation. Try to identify with the nation as an organic body. The problem is many of us don't have any sense of nationality or what a nation really is. Our nation, our nationhood is being threatened both from George Bush and the globalists and from the Islamists. And we, the people, have a right to defend ourselves and our nation through nationalism. And believe me, this message is not being lost on old boys in the CIA, old boys in the Defense Department, and people inside the FBI who know what's going on. They know exactly what's going on. Thanks for the call. But it's not my job to do this. Don't you understand that? Who am I? Nobody. I'm a guy not an undershirt. The summer's over. I'm in a I'm a guy in a flannel shirt with a toy poodle. I'm a guy in a red flannel shirt with a toy poodle named Teddy. That's really who I am. I'm giving you one man's opinion. No matter how vociferously I give it to you, it's still only one man's opinion. That's all it really is. That's all talk radio comes down to be. Do you understand that? And one of the reasons that I'm in the doldrums right now is because I'm an idealist. And as an idealist, I really thought that I could make a difference. I was never taken in by George Bush. Going back to the year 2000, I was very tepid about him. I knew what he was. I had no idea he was this bad. And I had to choose him over Gore because Gore would have been worse. Same thing again, 04. I knew Bush by 04 what he was. I knew that the entire structure was crumbling. I knew that they were going globalist. I saw the whole picture. I saw they were no longer taking positions on family values. I saw what they were doing already. But Kerry was worse, so I had to choose Bush and I had to support him. But as an idealist, after 15 years of fighting in the psychic trenches of this country's political battles, I am basically, I'm numb. I feel like I'm shell-shocked from it. What did we get? What did we get from George Bush after all these years? That's so much better than the Democrats. Oh, a little bit different. Not much. Not much different. What Bush gave us was the same thing they would have given us on a slightly slower track. They would have done it on a faster track. They would have skipped a few stations. That's about it. They would have given us this on the express train, you know. Now, as a result of George Bush's seven devastating years, the conservative movement is completely fractured. Family values have been destroyed. World unity is in disarray. The American people don't know which way they're turning. And we're all sitting here waiting for the arrival on the scene of the arch-Leninist Hillary Clinton, who already had power for 8 years. You know just what to expect from her. Only it's going to be much worse this time. If you like Sandy Berger, a national security advisor stealing documents out of the National Archives, he's a man who had to give up his law license for doing so, becoming again an advisor to Hillary Clinton. If you want to see the same panoply of perverts and criminals in the White House, well, you're going to get it. There's nothing I can do about it. Nothing whatsoever. Take a look at the 3Com deal. Many of you don't even know what it is because it's not being covered.
Yeah. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
I had such a bad experience on takeout last night. I have to tell you about it. I like restaurants. Don't get me wrong. I will go back to them. But right now, I'm not going to many. So actually, tonight, I'm going to go to one. So I did takeout last night. It was a very hot night. And I didn't want to eat. So I wait till it's dark to eat. Now it's too late to do it. So it's takeout. I call it in and I say to her, okay, I want the frutti di mare, the pasta. I've done this many times at this place. I want no clams. I want extra calamari. So the idiot, the high school student taking the order says, all right, no clams, extra calamari. I said, then I want a lot of bread. Then I want broccoli, no butter. I want Brussels sprouts, no butter. Boom. And I have someone go pick it up for me. An hour later, the food arrives. All clams, no calamari, and no bread. One slice of stale bread. So I was so upset. It was late. It was almost 10 o'clock. I started eating. But it starts to gall me. So I call up in the middle of eating with the dog looking at me. I can't give him any of this food, so I give him a piece of cheese, which he loves. We're sitting there in the dark by the water. And it was enjoyable. I mean, don't get me wrong. But if I say no clams, because I have to throw them out because I don't like clams. And I only like the other stuff, a shrimp and a calamari. So they give me the opposite. I call up and I try to explain it to her. It's a chain called Pasta Pomodoro. I mean, I'm not ashamed to tell you because it's too many times already the same thing. Too many times the same thing. And they have high school students taking the order. So I said to the manager what went on. She said, oh, I can't imagine she would do that. I said, yeah, but she also told the person who picked it up for me that there was no bread left. She said, I can't imagine that. We got loads of bread. So I said, well, what is she, crazy, stupid, a sadist? How could you run a restaurant like this? I said, you know, I'm getting so mad at you by you giving me these answers that I'm thinking of doing like the dry cleaner lawsuit where that, remember that lawyer sued the dry cleaner for like $8 million for a pair of pants? I almost understand what happened. He snapped probably. I said, if you keep this up, I said, I'm going to sue you for false advertising. If how many times have I said to you, no clams, extra calamari, and make sure you put bread in the thing and you send no bread. Maybe the fifth time in a row now? And I hung up on him. So this is what goes on. You know what it is? It's not her or the restaurant. You know what I found out lately? Nobody listens to anybody about anything. Have you noticed that in America today? It's in the service area, the service industries. Nobody listens to anybody. They don't want to hear you. They hate you. And it's not like my fault that I'm calling in an order. It doesn't make me a rich guy and that person poor. All I'm doing is ordering a schmucky takeout dinner alone in a house in an undershirt with a dog because that's where I want to be. Why can't they get it right? They always have to, like, give you something wrong. Is it the Bay Area? I want to know. Is this going on across America where no matter what you say to anybody in a service industry, they do it wrong on purpose? Nobody wants to do anything right. I've never seen anything like this. There's an anger. There's a subtext of anger by everybody. Is it any wonder that I take such pleasure in a simple creature like a dog? No. It's no wonder. Houston, Texas. Chris, you're on the Savage Nation.
I'm a proud father of a five-year-old, and I'm looking to get him a companion, a dog. And I want
you
to tell me the story of how you met Teddy.
You have to get him. I'll tell you, you could never do better than a small poodle, a miniature poodle, a 10-pounder. The little ones are too little for a child, I think. Like the 2-pounders, the child could accidentally hurt. But on a 10 or 11-pound dog at full, you know, full weight for a child, there's nothing better. This is like, I look at this dog sometimes, I think it's a living teddy bear. No matter what mood I'm in, Chris, as a grown man, he's the teddy bear I wanted to have when I was a child that my father wouldn't let me have because only sissies had teddy bears. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, sir, I do.
He wouldn't let me have a teddy bear. Oh, you don't need a teddy bear. You're a girl. Girls have dolls. You don't need a teddy bear. But Teddy is a living teddy bear. Sometimes he rolls on his back, looks at me in the eyes, with his eyes, and I can't explain it. Dogs have ways about him. That's how they get away with not working for a living. All they do is look cute. But he's a great dog. That breed is smart. He's very good with children. He likes children. I've never heard a bad thing with him. Maybe he's a special one. I don't know. This dog was picked off the internet from a breeder in Tennessee, believe it or not, and shipped out by plane. Would you believe it?
No, sir, I wouldn't, really. Off the internet.
No, you wouldn't believe it. On the internet. I wouldn't know whether to recommend it or not. I really do think you need to look at the animal you're going to buy because you don't know. But let's just talk breeds, Chris. How old is your child?
5 years old, sir.
Oh, he's perfect for a dog. This is just the age that a child could learn so much for taking care of himself by taking care of an animal. He learns that he has to take the dog for a walk once a day, even if it's to take him in a walk in the backyard, let's say. You don't want him out in the street, right? So you teach him, well, your dog has to go to the bathroom and you have to walk. Do you live in an apartment or a house, Chris?
I own a house, sir.
All right, so the child will learn that the dog is hungry like you, so you have to feed him every day. The dog gets dirty like a person does, so you have to bathe him and you have to brush him. And the dog sometimes doesn't feel good, you have to hold him. You know, because that's how a child learns. How do they learn otherwise? Otherwise, there's no way for them to learn. Either it's through a younger sibling or an animal. I think this is a wonderful thing to do for a child. So I would recommend Teddy. I mean, you can't have my dog. I actually want to breed him. I cannot find a little silver 11-pound girl for him. He's 3 years old. I really want him to have babies because I want to keep two of the dogs. I'll have three of them. I don't care what they do, how hard they are. I got to have another couple of them. I want to have, like, continuous cloning.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. To an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Hillary's donor linked to China missile trader Bernard Schwartz. Remember old Bernie? Oh, yeah, he's back in the news. Big man. He's on the boards of universities, now retired. He's an emeritus. Big man. He made his bundle now. He does the tuxedo and limo job. And that's the story about Hillary's donor linked to China missile trader. I got it from WND. It's up on michaelsavage.com. And there's old Bernie. Friend of Bill, remember old Schwartzy? Oh, yeah, he's on the board of the new school. Limo job and who is Bernard Schwartz? And what does Loral Space and Technology have to do with China's threat to the future of America? How is it tied into the Democrat machine? I don't know. Read the whole article. You'll read it. I don't have the time to explain it to you in detail. Read it up on michaelsavage.com. You'll see old Bernie. He's back. Remember, there's a big hullabaloo in 96. He sold missile technology to China, gave it to them. We developed it through our tax base for the military. Schwartz had it reclassified as not defense-related, moved to Commerce Department. He then transferred the technology to China so that the Chinese could launch satellites through their rocketry with our technology. He didn't do it to harm America. He's a good American, old Bernie Schwartz. You know that. He did it in order to launch satellites cheaper than a space could do it here in America. He was one of the first to outsource the launching of satellites. Smart businessman. It's like making a parachute with bad nylon. during the war, and it breaks when the guy jumps out of the plane on a bombing mission. Look, you got to make a buck. Nothing wrong with making a buck. So what if the other guy's son falls out of the plane and the chute doesn't open? The main thing is you have the limo and the suit. You go around, you got the bow tie, you go to the dinners. Don't matter that the moron in Fallujah has a flak jacket that couldn't stop a BB gun. That's all. So anyway, it's all tied in its own way. You got to follow it. If you have ADD, you could probably follow this. If you don't have ADD, I'm sure you have trouble following me half the time. See, a guy like me, think about it. I've written 23, 24 books published, several. I have quite a few books unpublished in manuscript. I've done the DVD. God knows I've earned the PhD, two master's degrees from great universities. I've published scholarly work. I've raised a family. I could be declared ADD when I could have been declared ADD as a kid. They would have killed me. I would have become like, I don't know what I would have been. An accordion playing accountant. And there's nothing wrong with being an accountant. Don't get me wrong. I love my accountant. I couldn't have been an accountant. I wasn't good with numbers. Let's say a journalist. Top thing, I could have worked in a newsroom on medication. You're semi-literate. You think that you're liberal. You're smart because you can type a sentence. Whatever the guy with the mustache that looks like Groucho Marx tells you to do, you do. You start out writing obituaries. Then you write the religion column. But you know what I'm saying is something else. Don't suppress a child's creativity who may be antsy and jumpy and this and that. That's the mark of intelligence, mostly. They become drummers. They become boxers. They become God knows what. What are you medicating it for? It's the mark of the child itself. So you got sick doctors now who don't have the guts to become actual crack dealers. And they prescribe medications for diseases that don't exist. And I told you I had a guy, Howie, in the name, but I'll repeat it. One guy I knew was a certifiable bug. The whole neighborhood, there was one bug. I don't know how old, 7, 8. He must have been 2 years younger than us. We were 10, 11. And he put on a Superman uniform in the house, ran around in it for a while. No one paid attention. Then one day he came like almost a traction. What happened? They were ashamed to admit. He threw himself down the steps. He thought he could fly. That was it. No one talked to him ever again in the neighborhood. I think they wouldn't even play like gin rummy with the father anymore than whatever they did. And today, I'm sure he's a supervisor in Austin, Texas, wearing a half a skirt and a half a mustache. Or he's on the board of supervisors of San Francisco voting that it's illegal to feed green parrots in the park, even though they love nature and they know everything about global warming. But don't feed the parrots, number one. And although we're liberals and we believe in free speech, Michael Savage should be condemned and be put in prison. And although Ed Jew is a third-generation Chinese-American, he doesn't belong here because we came from Hoboken and we're gay. And we know more about human rights. Just ask us. You see how it works? That's how it all works. That's how it all ties together. But you have to follow the show. You have to get into my syntax, my way of explaining things, to understand. If you're new to this, you probably don't know what I'm talking about. That's the problem. But it's after Labor Day. I'm warming up the crowd. They're not even in a tent yet. I have this idea. What is this now? Old hippies never die, they just become ugly. That's about the bean they had in the park. You ever see the disgusting drug addicts and sex maniacs there? That came to the park with the pot, big deal, dancing, 60s all over again. You take a look at those pictures, you could vomit. They still glorify the 60s in this city. You ever take a look at these people? Oh my God. What do they do for a living? How did they become like this? You see the schmatas they're wearing? Tie-dye they left over. You wouldn't want to go near it, the bugs in that dress that girl is there. See that dress she's wearing, that tie-dye? It was probably in her closet just for this event 30 years. Summer of Love bands and fans jam in Golden Gate Park. Kay Left and Heather danced to the music of the Rowan Brothers on Sunday at a free concert celebrating the 40th anniversary of the San Francisco Summer of Love. It was a summer of drugs and hate. It was a summer of love at Speedway Meadow. Yeah, it's called Speedway Meadow for a reason. There's nothing to do with cars going fast. Still jamming, huh? Hoo-hoo. 4L. Take a look at this motley crew. Everybody you look at in that crowd, let's say you look at that crowd, the pictures from the event, the being again thing. Every face you're looking at in that crowd, let's say everybody in there, anyone who went to that, do you realize that every picture and every person in that face is a tragedy to some family or other in the United States of America? Here's another one. Summer of Love, bands and fans jam at Golden Gate Park. All of the would-bes, wannabes. You look at the faces. Look carefully. There's some old hippies In my day, they would have been like a rabbi. Now the hair is long already. They're looking for. They're still trying to grab some at the, you know, a late age. They figure they're going to go there and see under someone's dress. Completely fallen people. They don't talk to anyone in the family. Nobody talks to them from New York or New Jersey anymore because they know they were nobody. They're kind of like wearing like an Aloha shirt for 30 years, the same shirt. It's like a good luck shirt, and it's got BO in it. You know the type I mean? There's guys around like that. How come they don't wash the shirt? Well, it's good luck. I started wearing it in 1969. I don't want to wash the stink out of it. So if you look at that, these pictures, every face in that picture, every old person, every person in that picture is a tragedy to some family or other. Both locally and nationally. Everyone. There's nobody there who did any good in their whole life. Nobody. Every last one of them, old hippies. So that my headline on the website is old hippies never die, they just become ugly. Am I mean-spirited for saying a thing like that? For telling you about Schwartz and Loral? For telling you that drug companies are poisoning our children? For telling you that the Democrats are the biggest liars in the history of this government? For telling you I don't believe that Bush cries a lot, I believe that God cries a lot because of Bush. Does that make me a mean-spirited guy? I don't think so. I don't think so at all. Then you got Whoopi Cushion Goldberg, a failure for the last 20 years. The only reason she's around is for the reasons you can understand. It's like affirmative action in entertainment. Fails in radio, now she's on TV again. What does she defend? She defends a guy who has dogs kill each other. But does anyone say anything? Oh, no. Why? Because she's a double minority. How could you say anything to Whoopi Cushion Goldberg? What else is in there? And poor Jerry Lewis. $80 million for muscular dystrophy, but he says half the F word, and bingo, the gay mafia wakes up after a bender, a three-day bender, and they who's on the list today? Oh, Jerry Lewis, rip him to shreds. He's no good. It's not money for us. Let's hear Jerry Lewis.
We're into hour 18. Look how good he moves that camera over your son of a gun. Wherever I go, he goes. Let's see what you do with this over here. Oh, your family has come to see you. You remember Bart, your older son? Jesse, the illiterate. No.
Oh, he said the F word. He's finished. Doesn't matter, he raised $62 million for muscular dystrophy. He got the gay mafia mad. Ooh. Such a genius, Jerry Lou. Even the French, they loved him. Well, okay, for reasons they loved him for different reasons than me, the French. I loved him because he was funny. They loved him because he was a stereotypical funny Jew, so they could laugh at Jews. That's why the French loved Jerry Lewis. It's not that they thought he was funny. They liked the Jew mocking Jewish-like behavior. It was like the anti-Semitism, and no one understands that about the French. You have to understand the French mind to understand why they glorify so many American artists. It's not that they actually think they do great work. They're mocking them because they mock everybody. That's why the whole nation is worthless. There's nothing positive coming out of France today. Zero. They can't even make a car in France. They used to make good. They made like the Mirage jet was a fabulous jet. I was watching the dogfight series on TV the other day. I bought the whole set the year one. I couldn't believe it. It was a great weekend. I don't mean Michael Vick with animal fights. I mean airplane dog fights. So probably one of the best things ever made in the history of television. I've never seen anything like it. So it's like about dog fighting, and they show the events that went on. Some of the pilots they were able to interview, they're still living, like 85 years old, who actually did the dog fighting, World War II, some in Korea, some in Vietnam, and some go back to other events. So I started with World War II. Then I jumped to the one on the 1967 Israeli war, and you see these guys. And they flew the Mirage jet against MiG-17s. And the strategy and the genius and the guts that these guys had. And you look at these guys, these Jewish guys, these Israelis, for example. These are the ones that showed them then, like pictures of these handsome, like desert warrior types then. And older men now, still very bold and noble men in their 50s or 60s. And what struck me was, the type still exists in Hollywood, but they're making pornography now. In other words, where did these guys go? What happened to them? What happened to the Jewish state? Everyone was so proud of them in the 60s. Then you like close your eyes and you wake up. It's like the ancient hippies, the aging hippies, who are ashamed to some family across America, every face in the picture. And now you look in Hollywood. Instead of being like old warriors who flew against MiG-17s over the Sinai, they made pornography in the valley. You know what I'm saying? And then they left their wife for a 19-year-old, a 19-year-old hooker they met. How does this happen to a world? It's one man's reflections. And again, you have to follow the show on a regular basis to understand what I am talking about. Unless you understand my entire gestalt, the gestalt of Michael Savage, you can't understand this. I would think this is very hard for a new listener. I heard he's good. What's he talking about? What does he mean, airplanes? How does he go from Ritalin to cyanide? What is he talking about? How does he go from depression and a guy who called and wanted to kill himself and talk about guys who flew against the MiG-17? I don't understand this. What's wrong with me? Why does he support Jerry Lewis when he said that word that they beeped? Why? What does he mean, the French are anti? I don't get it. It's too hard for me. I can't think. Give me a drug. Now go to watch Jay Leno. That's your speed. Two-dimension. Jay Leno on fish oils is two-dimensional. That's on a good day. Look, who's the guy who was on the show who wants to be president? I called him a glue horse, an old glue horse. Larry Craig? Fred, they're all the same to me. Larry Craig, Fred Thompson, they all look alike to me. Fred Thompson has as much chance to become president as the statue of Dante that I have in my studio that I'm looking at. Why would anyone vote for a glue horse who goes on Jay Leno and want him to protect us from the evils of the world? Who would want this? Right or wrong? Oh, hang on. No, Mike, he's really good. He's solid. Yeah, he's a solid. Well, he looks like a played the president. Well, what's the solid? What has he done that's good? Should he move back to Canada? Someone's asking me if they want to move to Canada. How do I know he should move? Look at these callers I got. I got a migraine from the topics already. And then you got the hippies in the park here in San Francisco. Crowd estimated 50,000 losers. The day began with blessings offered by Native American shamans. What they meant was shamed Native Americans who were no longer welcome on the reservation. Because they call them shamed men. Native American shamed men. And ended 9 hours later with Jolie Valenti, son of the late Dino Valenti. They listen to these people. Of Quicksilver Messenger Service singing his dad's song, Get Together. Wow, I missed that. Shoo, once in a lifetime. Whew. It's never too late for another summer of love, said Wes Scoop Nisker, former underground radio newscaster. Wow, how far out? Underground radio newscaster. Ooh, I missed him. I haven't felt like this since 1969, said Woodstock concert producer Artie Kornfeld, one of the many Red Diaper Doper Baby counterculture heroes who appeared during the brief intermissions in the crisply efficient production. The old hippies look a little worn. No kidding. No kidding. They should be where Jerry Garcia is, enjoying it. Paul Kantner. Oh, my God. That loser is still around? Who is he? Did he bring his walker or the trend? Was he able to play with the transfusion tree or not? Beat poet Michael McClure? That guy was nobody when he was somebody. The only person who thought Michael McClure was a poet was Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who was a clever businessman in disguise. Oh, my God. They're still around? How do they stay alive? What is it, from eating beans or something? Why, it's from running out on bills in North Beach in the 70s. I went to dinner with a lot of these guys. You go to, like, these are all, like, with the proletariat, down with the proletariat. We're with the people, man. We're down with the people. All these great poets. We used to eat in North Beach in these big family-style Italian restaurants. And when the bill came, they paid to the penny if they paid that and ran out with no tip. They left the waiter. You know what they left the waiter? Spittle on the table. That's what they left. There was, like, 8 cents left on it. Did you ever go to dinner with, like, old hippies? But they leave for a tip 8 cents. They're all ashamed to somebody. Some family somewhere in New Jersey is broken from them. That's all I know. Somebody in Staten Island has a broken heart. They're buried in a grave. Everyone that they're mentioning here, they don't go back home for nothing. Not a religious ceremony, a wedding. No one wants to know them. They're outcasts. But they're reliving. They're reliving. Every face in those pictures that you see reprinted on the, republished on the website, every face you are looking at, that went to this reenactment of the summer of hate and summer of drug addiction in San Francisco. Every last one of them. Do you realize when you look at them that every last one of them reflects a tragedy to some family or other in the United States of America? It's unbelievable to me. I'm going to read on an article. At the far end of the field, a cluster of food stands. Let me ask you something. Would you eat food at a food stand at a hippie festival? And arts and crafts booths, probably all made in China. Stanley Moose, the psychedelic artist who drew the Grateful Dead skull and roses. Ooh, I missed him too? Wow. God, did I miss this stuff. I was on my boat driving it under the San Francisco Bay Bridge. I wanted to see the genius of the contractor who floated like a 50-foot section off the bridge and on the bridge in 2 days and got it back up before it was expected to go up, because it's not Caltrans. It wasn't a state that did it. It was a private contractor. The guy should be given a Nobel Prize. I went out in the boat in the rough water with the white waves, the spray hitting me in the face. I felt a smile come over my face.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
I got to tell a half-man, half-woman story in Long Beach. I'm not talking about the supervisors of San Francisco. I'm talking about a long time ago in New York City. Dad had a small antique store. I told you he sold clocks and figures and statues, mainly 19th century French, and some of it was very good. So amongst the many customers, one of them was a circus performer in the freak show of Ringling Brothers, who would get up there half man, half woman. I don't know. He had a breast on one side, and the other side he didn't. I don't know how they did with a half a beard. But, you know, after work, he was a regular person, and he lived in a house in Long Beach, like one of those little Godfather houses. So Dad would deliver the work after work. He delivered his own, you know, sales. He didn't have a delivery boy. And I would, you know, I was the kid. I'd go along on the ride, whether it would be the DeSoto or the Cadillac Model 62 with the statues in the back. And we pull up late at night because this guy didn't like to come out during the day. I'll never forget this as long as I live. So the circus guy, the half man, half woman, ring, ring, who's there? Blah, blah, blah. So the guy opens the door, but he can't open the door all the way. He can only open it a crack. Why can he only? And he has to, like, pull the door and push stuff to get. And the house is now littered with art objects in no particular order. Hundreds of statues and paintings on the floor, nothing hung right. He would buy one beautiful thing after another and just randomly put it on the floor like a warehouse.